Imagine you've got this genuinely wild, brilliant idea for a startup. You're so excited to pick up your phone, you dial a buddy you've known for years, and you just ask one simple question.
Right, just gauging interest.
Exactly, like, hey, if I put together some shares for this new company, would you want to invest? And your buddy laughs, says no way, and hangs up the phone immediately.
Not a single dime changes hands.
Right. You just go about your day. Well, did you just break the law under state securities regulations? You absolutely did.
Is honestly one of the harshest realities of the financial industry. The law does not wait for the victim to lose their money before it steps in.
Yeah, and we're going to get deep into why that is in just a second. But real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com.
It's a lifesaver for this stuff.
Truly is. Okay, let's dive into the deep end here. If you are tuning in today, you are likely staring down the barrel of the Series 63 exam. And specifically, you're looking at the source material for securities registration methods, which is, I mean, this is the heavy stuff.
Oh, it is the heavy stuff. It
Yeah.
accounts for roughly 9% of the entire exam.
Wow, 9%.
Yeah, so that is a significant chunk of your passing score, entirely dependent on understanding how securities get cleared for sale at the state level.
Yeah.
And the biggest mistake I see people make here is treating the Uniform Securities Act like just a random collection of numbers and deadlines that they have to rote memorize.
Right, like flashcarding yourself to death.
Exactly. If you just try to memorize that, a certain wait period is 5 days and another is 10 days, your memory will completely evaporate the second you sit down in that testing center. We need to look at the structural architecture of the system from the sources. We have to understand why the regulators built it this way.
Right, because if you understand the logic, you can reverse engineer any trick question they throw at you. So to do this, we are absolutely not going to just read a textbook at you today.
Definitely not.
We are going to explore this entire regulatory labyrinth through the lives of three recurring characters. These three are going to be our guides today. First up, we have Frank the founder.
Classic Frank.
Frank is chaotic. He is a hyper-enthusiastic entrepreneur who runs entirely on cold brew coffee and irrational optimism. He's constantly trying to launch bizarre companies, and today his grand vision is an underground emu farm.
An underground emu farm, which, from a purely logistical standpoint, sounds like an absolute
Oh
nightmare.
yeah, the logistics do not matter to Frank. He's a big picture guy. Now, sitting next to Frank is broker Bob. Bob is Frank's eager, slightly impatient broker. He wears suits that are a little too shiny. He lives on his phone, and his only goal in life is to close a deal and collect a commission.
He tends to act first and read the rule book, never, which in the securities industry is a profoundly dangerous personality trait.
Yeah, very dangerous. Which brings us to our final character, the person standing between Frank, Bob, and the general public, cautious Carla.
Ah, Carla.
Carla is the state securities administrator. She is strict, she is uncompromisingly fair. She loves paperwork, and her primary directive in life is protecting the public from guys like Frank and Bob.
Carla represents the state government. She embodies the Uniform Securities Act. She has this very heavy, very final red stamp on her desk, and she does not hesitate to use it if she smells anything remotely fishy.
So Frank wants to sell his emu stock. Bob wants to facilitate the sale, pump up the volume, and get paid. Carla wants to make sure nobody's grandmother loses her retirement fund to an underground bird farm. Let's start with the absolute baseline from our sources. Before we figure out how Frank registers his security, when do these rules even kick in?
Well, it all comes down to a deceptively simple rule in the USA, the Uniform Securities Act. It states that it is unlawful for any person to offer or sell any security in a state unless one of three conditions is met.
Okay, what are they?
Number one, the security is registered under the act. Number two, the security or the transaction is exempt from registration. Or number three, the security is a federal covered security. That is the whole universe, registered, exempt, or federal covered.
But wait, this brings us right back to that hook at the start. You said it's unlawful to offer or sell. That phrasing feels like a trap. I mean, if Bobby just offers the stock but nobody buys it, why does Carla care? There's no victim yet.
Okay, I'm hitting the imaginary exam trap buzzer right now. The exam will test this aggressively. The USA covers attempts to sell. It covers solicitations of an offer to buy. You cannot even casually ask a client to gauge their interest without triggering the registration requirement.
So no testing the waters.
None. The rationale here is purely preventative. State regulators learned decades ago that if they wait until a fraudulent sale is actually completed, the money is already gone.
Right, it's in an offshore account.
Exactly, and the scammer is gone. By making the offer itself illegal, Carla gains a legal authority to shut down a boiler room operation the moment they start making cold calls, long before a single investor cuts a check.
Okay, pause for a second. Direct question to you, the listener. If Broker Bob calls up his buddy and just asks if he wants to buy Frank's Emu Farm stock, but the buddy hangs up, did Bob break the registration rule? Give you a beat. Yes, yes, he did. A solicitation alone triggers the requirement. Keep that straight in your head. The solicitation is the crime. Yeah. The state doesn't need to see a receipt.
Precisely. Now, assuming Bob actually wants to do this legally, he needs to get the security cleared. And the absolute best case scenario for Bob and Frank is to somehow bypass cautious Carla entirely.
Right, because dealing with Carla means paperwork audits and delays. So how does Frank get to just walk right past Carla? Let's get into what the industry calls federal covered securities. I like to think of this as the VIP pass.
VIP pass is a great way to think about it. To understand a federal covered security, you really have to understand the nightmare that existed before 1996. Back in the 80s and early 90s, the state and federal systems were completely duplicated.
Oh, gross.
Yeah, if a massive multi-billion dollar blue chip company wanted to issue new stock, Rick, they had to register with the SEC at the federal level. That took months of intense scrutiny. But then they had to take that exact same massive stack of paperwork and send it to 50 different cautious Carlas in 50 different states.
That sounds insanely inefficient. I mean, 50 different Carlas.
It was paralyzing. Each state had its own quirky rules, its own waiting periods, its own fees. A company would have to hire an army of 50 different local law firms just to navigate the state-level blue sky laws. It choked capital formation. So in 1996, Congress stepped in and passed the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, or NSMIA.
NSMIA, okay.
Yes. The core philosophy of NSMIA was simple. If a security is large enough or regulated tightly enough at the federal level, the federal government legally preempts the states from requiring registration. If a security earns the title of federal covered security, the state is legally barred from demanding registration.
So it's literally a federal VIP pass. Mm. Frank walks up to the hottest nightclub, let's call it the Texas Capital Markets. Carla is the bouncer. Frank flashes his NSMIA VIP pass. Can Carla do anything? Does she just have to let him in for free and look the other way?
Well, not exactly. She can't block him from entering. She cannot demand he go through his state-level registration gauntlet. However, for most of these VIPs, Carla still retains a little bit of power. She can demand a cover charge.
A cover charge?
Yes, formerly known as a notice filing and a fee. She can say, fine, you're federal covered. You can come in, but you still have to give me a copy of the documents you filed with the SEC, and you have to pay the state filing fee. She can also require Frank to sign a consent to service of process, which basically means if Frank breaks the rules in her state, she can serve him with legal papers.
Okay, so that's the cover charge. But what if Frank gets into the club? He starts selling his federal covered stock, but he's just straight up lying to people. Like, what if he is committing massive fraud, telling everyone the emus lay solid gold eggs? Is Carla helpless because of the preemption?
Okay, listener, I want you to really focus on this. Direct question for you. If an exchange-listed stock is totally exempt from state registration and stop orders, can Carla do anything if Frank is lying about his financials? Think about it. Yes, she can. States always retain anti-fraud authority. NSMIA preempted registration. It did not preempt fraud prosecution.
Wow, because you cannot preempt fraud.
Never. Carla can't stop the stock from being offered based on administrative rules. But the second Frank commits fraud, she can investigate issue subpoenas and drag him into state court.
I love that. So who actually gets this VIP pass? Our sources list a few very specific categories, and I know they aren't all treated equally. Who's at the absolute top of the food chain?
The ultimate VIPs are exchange-listed securities. If Frank's Emu Farm somehow goes public and gets listed on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ or any national exchange, he achieves total immunity from Carla's administrative process.
Wait, total immunity? Does he still pay the cover charge?
No.
Yeah.
For exchange-listed securities, Carla gets absolutely nothing. No state registration, no notice filing, no state fee, and she cannot issue an administrative stop order against the offering. The logic here is that the listing standards for the NYSE are so incredibly strict regarding corporate governance, public float, and financial reporting that the federal government feels the states literally have nothing useful to add to the screening process.
Okay, so exchange listed equals a total bypass. What's the next category down?
Investment companies. Think mutual funds. This would be a security issued by a company registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940.
So if like Vanguard or Fidelity wants to sell mutual fund shares in Carla State, are they treated like the exchange listed stocks? Do they breeze right past her without bidding?
They do not. Mutual funds skip the formal state registration process. They don't have to prove their financial viability to Carla, but they do have to pay the cover charge. Carla can require a notice filing. She collects her state fee, and she gets that consent to service of process. And crucially, if the mutual fund refuses to pay the state fee, Carla is legally allowed to issue a stop order to halt their sales in her state until they pay up.
Makes sense. The state still wants its tax revenue, right? Okay, what's the third VIP category?
This one is dangerous territory for the exam. The third category involved private placements under Regulation D of the Securities Act of 1933.
Regulation D. Okay, so if a company's doing a private placement, meaning they aren't selling to the general public, they are quietly raising money behind closed doors, they get the federal VIP pass.
Not all of them. This is the trap. There are different tiers within Regulation D. The exam will give you a generic Regulation D offering and ask if it is a federal covered security. The answer is that only the uncapped tier, which is Federal Rule 506, is federal covered.
Oh.
If a company uses one of the smaller dollar Regulation D tiers, like Rule 504, it is not federal covered. For those smaller offerings, Frank would still have to register with Cautious Carla or find a separate state exemption.
Why does the federal government only give the VIP pass to the massive Rule 506 tier?
Because Rule 506 offerings have no dollar limit. They can raise hundreds of millions, and they are generally restricted to accredited investors like wealthy individuals and institutions. Congress decided that if you're raising massive amounts of capital, mostly from rich, sophisticated people, the federal rules are enough. The states don't need to babysit millionaires.
But wait, I'm looking at our source material, and it specifically says the uncapped tier is federal covered, regardless of whether the purchasers are accredited or non-accredited.
Excellent catch. Rule 506 does allow a company to sell to up to 35 non-accredited but highly sophisticated investors. The exam writers will use this against you. They will present a scenario where a Rule 506 private placement is sold to a non-accredited investor, and they will ask if it loses its federal covered status.
Let me guess. People assume that because a non-accredited normal person is buying it, Carla must step in to protect them.
Exactly. But it's a trick. As long as the offering is conducted under the uncapped Rule 506 tier, it remains a federal covered security period. Even if non-accredited investors are involved, Carla can't demand state registration.
But she can demand the notice filing, right? The cover charge?
Yes. For this uncapped Reg D tier, Carla can require a notice filing on a specific federal document called SEC Form D, along with a fee. But the timing is highly testable.
Okay, if you're listening, lock this into your brain. When does that Form D have to hit Carla's desk?
Form D must be filed with the state administrator no later than 15 days after the first sale of the security in that state.
Not the first offer. Not 15 days before the sale. 15 days after the first sale. That feels a bit backward, right? Usually Carla wants to see the paperwork before money changes hands.
It does feel backward, but it reflects the reality of private placements. These are fast-moving private deals. The regulators concede that as long as it's a federal-covered private placement, the issuer can close the first deal, take the check, and then they have a 15-day grace period to essentially let the state know, hey, we just started doing business here. Here's your paperwork and your fee.
Okay, we have one final VIP category.
Sales to qualified purchasers. This one is unique because whether it's federal covered or not doesn't depend on what the company is or how the stock is sold. It depends entirely on who is buying it. A qualified purchaser is defined by federal statute. Usually we are talking about massive institutions or individuals with tens of millions of dollars in investments. If Frank manages to sell his EMU stock to a qualified purchaser, that specific transaction is federal covered.
Because if a billionaire hedge fund decides to buy Frank's EMU stock, the government assumes the hedge fund has enough lawyers to protect itself. Carla doesn't need to hold their hand.
Precisely. Now, before we move on to how state registration actually works, the sources highlight a very tricky area. There are three specific types of securities that are federally exempt from SEC registration, but they are not federal covered securities.
So they get a pass from Washington, D.C., but they do not get a pass from Carla.
Exactly. Congress said, we don't want to regulate these at the federal level, but we are explicitly leaving them to the states to handle. You need to be able to spot these three exceptions.
What are they?
First, securities issued by nonprofits. Charities, religious organizations, educational institutions. Second, securities issued in fairness hearing reorganizations. This usually involves bankruptcies or corporate mergers that are approved by a state court or government agency.
Why do states want to control nonprofits? That seems mean.
Unfortunately, affinity fraud is a massive problem.
Mm-hmm.
Scammers will often set up fake charities or use religious affiliations to con people out of their savings. Because these organizations don't file with the SEC, the states insist on retaining jurisdiction, so Carla can keep a very close eye on local charity bond offerings.
Wow, okay. Affinity fraud is awful. And the third exception.
Intrastate offerings. Rule 147. This is when a company is incorporated in one state and it only sells its securities to residents of that exact same state.
Well, that makes perfect sense from a constitutional perspective. If Frank's emu farm is in Texas and he only sells stock to people who live in Texas, it never crosses state lines. The federal government has no interstate commerce jurisdiction.
Exactly. Washington doesn't care. But Carla in Texas cares deeply. Because there is no SEC oversight, Carla has absolute total authority over that intrastate offering. It is not a federal covered security. She will demand full state registration.
Okay, and just to put a bow on the federal covered section, there's a weird quirk about municipal bonds. Say the city of Austin, Texas issues a bond to build a new bridge. Is that federal covered?
A municipal bond is a federal covered security everywhere in the United States, except in the state where the municipality is located. Let me make sure I have that straight. If Austin, Texas issues a bond, Carla, the Texas administrator, does not treat it as a federal covered security. She can regulate it. But if someone in New York buys that Austin bond, the New York administrator has to treat it as federal covered and can't touch it.
That is correct. States retain the right to regulate their own cities and towns, but they cannot regulate the municipal bonds issued by other states.
Incredible. Okay, so that is the VIP list. But what happens to the 99% of businesses out there that don't qualify? Frank doesn't have a giant public company. He's not doing a massive Rule 506 private placement to millionaires. He is just a guy trying to raise capital from normal people. He doesn't have the federal VIP pass. He has to register his securities directly with Carla.
And this is where we enter the core of state securities law. There are three different methods for registering a security at the state level: filing coordination and qualification.
And if you just try to memorize the lists of requirements for each one, your brain is going to melt. So I want to talk about a framework for this. As I was reviewing the notes from the sources, I kept picturing a teeter-totter. You know, a seesaw.
The teeter-totter is an excellent analogy. Let's build it out. What is balancing on either side?
So on one side of the teeter-totter, you have eligibility. How hard is it for a company to even be allowed to use this specific registration method? Do they need millions in revenue years of history and federal approval? That's the eligibility way. On the other side of the teeter-totter, you have the filing burden. How much agonizing paperwork, how many audits, how many contracts do they actually have to hand over to Carla?
And the fundamental rule of state registration is that there's an inverse relationship between these two sides.
Mm-hmm.
They perfectly balance each other out based on trust.
Break that down. Where does the trust come from?
The trust comes from federal oversight and market history. If a massive seasoned company have been filing pristine quarterly reports with the SEC for years, and they have millions of dollars in the bank, the state regulators trust them. Therefore, the eligibility criteria to use the most streamlined method is incredibly heavy. It's very hard to qualify for. But if you do clear that massive eligibility hurdle, the teeter-totter tips and your state filing burden is practically zero. Carla just asks for a quick heads up and a tiny bit of paperwork.
That's registration by filing, the hardest club to get into, but once you're in, the drinks are free.
Correct. Now push the teeter-totter all the way in the opposite direction. What if a company has absolutely no history? No SEC filings, no net worth, no public float. They are completely unproven. In this case, the eligibility hurdle is zero. Anyone can play. But because there is zero trust, the teeter-totter slams down on the other side. The filing burden is astronomical. Carla is going to demand to see every single piece of paper the company has ever generated. She takes on the burden of investigating the company from scratch.
And that is registration by qualification. No eligibility requirements, massive paperwork. And then sitting right in the middle, balancing both sides evenly, is registration by coordination. Moderate eligibility, moderate paperwork.
Exactly. Filing, coordination, qualification. If you understand the teeter-totter, you can deduce the answers to most questions the exam will ask about these methods.
All right, let's take these one by one and dig into the actual mechanics. First up, registration by filing, also known in some states as registration by notification. This is the one with the massive eligibility hurdle. Who actually gets to use this?
Well, the exam wants to make sure you know that there isn't just one path to registration by filing. There are two completely distinct routes, and they have entirely different rules. Route A is for seasoned corporate issuers. Route B is for mutual funds and unit investment trusts.
Okay, let's start with Route A. Let's pretend Frank's emu farm was actually wildly successful. 30 years have passed. He's now the CEO of EmuCorp, a giant public entity. ImmuCorp wants to issue a new block of stock, and they want to use registration by filing in Carla's state. What does Frank have to prove to Carla to clear that eligibility hurdle?
The thresholds are severe, and ImmuCorp must meet every single one of them simultaneously. First, ImmuCorp must be actively engaged in U.S. business operations for at least 36 consecutive months immediately preceding the filing.
3 full years of active operations, no shell companies allowed.
Exactly. Second, they must have a class of equity securities currently registered with the SEC that is held by 500 or more persons of record.
Why 500? Why not like 50? What is the logic there?
It goes back to the wisdom of the crowd and market efficiency. The state regulators believe that if a company has 500 independent shareholders actively reviewing the company's financials and voting on corporate matters, it's very correct. And they also need substantial public float. There must be no less than 400,000 units of the registered class of securities held by the public. And note, the public excludes shares held by officers, directors, or anybody holding 10% or more of the stock. It must be 400,000 shares freely trading in the hands of everyday investors.
Again, Carla is looking for a deep, liquid market. But wait, ImmuCorp's hurdles aren't done yet. What about the brokers and the stock price itself?
There must be at least 4 market makers for the registered class of stock during at least 30 days of the 3 preceding months.
Let's pause on that. 4 market makers. A market maker is a broker-dealer firm that stands ready to buy and sell the stock on a regular basis to keep the market fluid. Why does Carla demand 4 of them?
Because illiquidity is a massive risk for retail investors. If there's only 1 market maker and that firm goes bankrupt or decides to stop trading the stock, the investors are trapped. They can't sell their shares. 4 independent market makers guarantee that ImmuCorp's stock is highly liquid. If an investor wants out, they can easily get out.
It's all about risk reduction.
Okay, and what about the price of the stock? Can a penny stock use this method?
Absolutely not. The equity securities being offered must be priced at not less than $5 per share. The history here is critical. In the 1980s and 90s, the biggest scams in the country were penny stock boiler rooms, manipulating shares that traded for 10 cents or 50 cents. State regulators drew a hard line. If your stock is under $5, it is inherently more speculative and susceptible to manipulation. You do not get to use the fast lane.
And finally, ImmuCorp can't have any recent black marks on its record, right?
Right. No defaults. ImmuCorp cannot have failed to pay a preferred dividend. They can't have defaulted on any bond or debt, and they cannot have defaulted on any material long-term lease since the end of their last fiscal year.
Okay, so Frank clears this absurdly high bar. He meets every single one of those conditions. The teeter-totter tips. How easy is the actual paperwork he has to give Carla? It's incredibly light. He basically hands Carla a statement proving he meets all those eligibility tests, some very basic details about the company, a description of the security being offered, and a copy of the federal prospectus he already filed with the SEC. That is it.
And now for the most important question, the one the exam loves to test. Frank filed the paperwork. When does this seasoned issuer registration actually become effective? When can Broker Bob start officially making sales to the public? Does Carla have to review it and stamp it?
She does not. For Route A, the seasoned issuer, the state registration becomes effective concurrently with the federal registration statement. That means the very millisecond the SEC in Washington declares the offering effective restri. Carla's state registration automatically becomes effective by operation of law.
But there is a catch. There's always a catch.
The catch is a waiting period. The required state paperwork must have been on file with Carla for at least 5 business days before that concurrent effectiveness can trigger.
5 business days. So if Bob files the paperwork on a Wednesday, he's counting Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Weekends don't count. It has to sit on Carla's desk for 5 full business days. If the SEC clears Frank on day 3, too bad. Bob has to wait for Carla's 5-day clock to run out. But once those 5 business days are up, the state and federal approvals sync up perfectly.
Correct. Now let's contrast that entirely with Route B.
Route B. This is for mutual funds and unit investment trusts, UITs. Now you said earlier that mutual funds are federal covered securities. Why are we talking about them registering at the state level?
Because this rule largely applies to older funds or funds interacting with states under legacy provisions or simply paying their notice filing fees using this mechanism. The critical thing the exam tests is how their filing rules differ from seasoned corporations.
Do Vanguard and Fidelity have to prove they have a $4 million net worth and 36 months of history?
No. Route B completely bypasses all those financial and operating history tests. The teeter-totter logic still applies, but the trust comes from a different source. Instead of looking at their balance sheet, the state uses a prior qualification test. To use registration by filing the mutual fund, just needs to have previously qualified the sale of its securities in that specific state within the preceding 24 months.
So if a mutual fund went through the hassle of registering in Texas a year and a half ago, and now they want to issue a new series of shares, Texas says, hey, we just vetted you 18 months ago. You're fine. Just use the filing method.
Exactly. It's a regulatory renewal shortcut. And for a unit investment trust, a UIT, the rule is even more relaxed. A UIT can use registration by filing if its sponsor previously registered a substantially identical UIT in that state.
So if a huge financial firm sponsors dozens of different UITs and they registered one last year, any new similar UIT they launch can use this fast lane.
Yes. But here is the exam trap you need to watch out for. What is the time limit for that UIT sponsor branch?
If I'm listening to this, I'm probably guessing 24 months because you just said 24 months for mutual funds.
Then that is exactly what the exam writers want you to guess. But there is no time limit for the UIT sponsor branch. If a sponsor registered a substantially identical UIT 10 years ago, they can still use registration by filing today. The 24-month clock only applies to the mutual fund renewing its own registration.
That is incredibly sneaky.
Yeah.
So Route B has totally different eligibility rules. What about the effective date? For EmuCorp, the seasoned issuer, we said they have to wait 5 business days and then it becomes effective concurrently with the SEC. Is it the same for mutual funds?
No. This is where people lose points. On Route B, the open-end fund and UIT route, the registration becomes effective on the business day of filing or when their existing registration expires, whichever happens last.
Wait, let me hear that again. If a mutual fund uses Route B, they just walk into Carla's office, hand her the paper, pay the fee, and it's effective that exact same day.
Yes. There is absolutely no 5 business day waiting period.
Okay.
And there is no tie to federal effectiveness. It operates on its own independent clock.
Yeah. Okay, if you're taking notes, draw a massive line down the middle of your page. Route A, seasoned issuers, 5 business days, wait concurrent with SEC. Route B, mutual funds, effective the day of filing. Do not let the exam mix those up.
That is excellent advice. Now let's slide to the middle of the teeter-totter. What if Frank, the founder, is taking EmuCorp public for the very first time? It's a standard initial public offering. He doesn't have 36 months of SEC history. He doesn't have 400,000 shares freely trading because he hasn't sold any yet. He is completely locked out of registration by filing. What does he do?
He moves to method 2, registration by coordination, the workhorse.
That's always.
This is what the vast majority of standard IPOs use, right?
Yes. Coordination is the most common state registration method. The eligibility requirement is incredibly simple. Any security for which a registration statement has been filed under the Federal Securities Act of 1933 in connection with the same offering may be registered by coordination.
So Frank is filing all his massive, complicated paperwork with the SEC in Washington, D.C. He can essentially just turn to cautious Carla in his home state and say, hey, I'm doing a federal offering. Let's coordinate our schedules.
Exactly. He is coordinating his state registration with his federal registration. Carla isn't going to make him jump through financial hoops like the $4 million net worth because she knows the SEC is currently crawling all over his books.
But Carla still wants to see the paperwork right. The filing burden is moderate. What does Frank have to give her?
He has to give her 3 copies of the latest federal prospectus. She can ask for the articles of incorporation bylaws, underwriting agreements, and a copy of any other document filed with the SEC. But the single most important piece of paper Frank must sign is called the undertaking.
The undertaking. It sounds like he's making a vow. What is he promising, Carla?
Frank must promise. He must formally undertake to forward any future amendments made to the federal prospectus to Carla promptly. And the statute defines promptly no later than the first business day after they are forwarded to or filed with the SEC.
Let me put myself in Bob's shoes. Let's say Bob and Frank get a call from the SEC on a Tuesday afternoon. The SEC says your risk disclosures are weak. We need you to amend page 40 of your prospectus. Frank's lawyers rewrite the page and file the amendment in Washington on Wednesday morning. Bob cannot just sit on that. He must send that exact same amendment to Carla no later than Thursday, the first business day. Why is Carla so intense about this timeline?
Because of how the effective date works. Carla is going to allow Frank's state registration to become effective automatically at the exact same millisecond as federal registration becomes effective. She is blindly trusting the SEC's timeline. But to do that safely, she needs absolute certainty that the paperwork sitting on her desk is identical to the paperwork sitting on the SEC's desk. If the SEC forces Frank to reveal a massive pending lawsuit and Frank hides that amendment from Carla, Carla is flying blind. The first business day rule ensures information parity.
That makes total sense. Okay, let's talk about the timing rules for coordination. We know it becomes effective concurrently with the SEC, But just like filing had that 5 business day waiting period, coordination has its own holding pattern, right?
Yes, and these are highly testable. There are 2 distinct waiting periods that must both be satisfied before the state registration can become effective. First, the registration statement must have been on file with Carla for at least 10 days.
10 days, and notice it doesn't say 10 business days. The seasoned issuer under filing had to wait 5 business days. Coordination is 10 calendar days. Okay, what is the second waiting period?
Second, a statement of the maximum and minimum proposed offering prices and the maximum underwriting discounts and commissions must have been on file with Carla for 2 full business days.
Okay, if you are listening right now, I want you to think about this logically. Broker Bob files a document with Carla. It says, "We aren't sure yet, but we propose selling Frank's E-New stock for somewhere between $10 and $15 a share. He leaves it on her desk for 2 full business days. Is this max min proposed price document the exact same thing as the final federal price amendment that locks in the final price of the stock? Give you a beat.
It absolutely is not. And the exam will try to trick you into conflating the two.
How do they differ?
The max min statement is an early estimate, is a range. Carla just wants a ballpark figure of what this offering is going to look like, and she wants time to review it. Hence the 2 full business days requirement before effectiveness. The federal price amendment, on the other hand, is the final definitive document filed with the SEC, often just hours before the offering goes live, locking in the exact price, say $12.50.
Okay, so let's walk through the final hours of an IPO. The 10 days have passed, the 2 full business days for the maximum estimate have passed. Frank and Bob are sitting in a conference room. The SEC picks up the phone and says, "Congratulations, your federal registration is effective right now." Frank's state registration automatically becomes effective at that exact same second. But Bob has one final job, right? The oops penalty.
Yes. Even though it is effective automatically, Bob must promptly notify Carla by telephone or telegram. And yes, the law still allows telegrams of the exact date and time the federal registration became effective and the exact content of that final price amendment. And then he has to promptly file a formal state post-effective amendment containing that final data.
What happens if Bob is so thrilled that the SEC cleared the IPO that he pops a bottle of champagne, heads to a steakhouse, starts selling shares, and completely forgets to call Carla?
If Bob fails to notify Carla, she can bring the entire operation to a screeching halt. She can enter a stop order denying or suspending the effectiveness of the registration, and she can do it without notice or hearing.
Wait, usually if a state administrator wants to shut down a business, there's due process involved, right? They have to hold a hearing first.
Normally, yes. But a missed notification on a coordination filing is a rare statutory exception. Because Bob broke the specific procedural promise of the coordination method, Carla can retroactively suspend effectiveness instantly.
So Bob realizes his mistakes the next morning, panics, and calls Carla. Is the IPO dead forever?
No. If Bob subsequently proves to Carla that he did in fact comply with all the federal requirements and that the SEC really did declare them effective, the stop order is voided retroactively as of the time of its entry.
Carla says, "Don't ever ignore me again," voids the order, and they are back in business. Okay, so that is coordination, the workhorse, 10 calendar days on file, 2 full business days for the max min estimate, concurrent effectiveness. Now let's slide all the way to the far end of the teeter-totter, method 3, registration by qualification.
Qualification is the fallback method. It is the catch-all.
Let's set a new scenario. Frank, the founder, decides Washington, D.C. is too much trouble. He doesn't want to deal with the SEC. He wants to do an intrastate offering. He is only going to sell his EMU farm stock to people who reside in his home state of Texas. He relies on Rule 147, so he files absolutely nothing with the federal government. He walks into Carla's office in Texas. Can he use registration by filing?
No filing requires a concurrent federal registration.
Can you use coordination?
No coordination requires coordinating with an active SEC registration.
So he is forced to use qualification. Who is actually eligible for this method?
Any security can be registered by qualification.
Yeah.
There are absolutely no eligibility restrictions. You don't need a massive net worth. You don't need a 36-month history. You don't even need a federal registration.
But the teeter-totter demands balance. If anyone can use it, the filing burden must be agonizing.
Agonizing is putting it mildly. Because the SEC is not reviewing this offering, cautious Carla is entirely on her own. She has no federal paperwork to lean on. Therefore, she has to do all the heavy lifting herself to ensure this isn't a scam. The USA mandates that Frank must provide 17 different categories of intensely detailed information.
17 categories. Let me read a few of these because it really paints a picture of how invasive this is. Frank has to give Carla detailed descriptions of the company's physical properties and competitive conditions. He has to give her the 5-year occupational history of every single officer and director.
And it gets deeper. He must disclose every material transaction those officers have had with the company in the past 3 years.
Let's think about why she needs that. Say Frank is leasing the land for the emu farm from his own brother, and he's paying his brother $5 million a year in rent for a dirt patch. That's a material transaction. It drains investor money into Frank's family. Without the SEC looking, Carla's the only one who can catch that. What else does she need?
Frank must provide the aggregate remuneration, the total compensation paid to all directors and officers for the past year and estimated for the next 12 months. He has to list every person who owns 10% or more of the stock. He has to provide a complete detailed capitalization table.
And wait, there's more. Frank has to give Carla a description of all outstanding stock options. He must hand over copies of every single material contract the company has entered into. He has to hand over all intended sales literature, prospectuses, advertisements. He needs a formal legal opinion from counsel on the legality of the security. And of course, a balance sheet from within 4 months of filing and profit and loss statements for the last 3 fiscal years.
Carla leaves absolutely no stone unturned. She is forcing Frank to build a comprehensive SEC-level profile of his business from scratch, purely for her state-level review.
So Frank spends 3 months gathering all this paperwork. It's a mountain of bankers' boxes. He submits all 17 categories flawlessly on a Monday morning. The fee is paid. Everything is perfect. When does registration by qualification actually become effective? When can Bob start selling? Think about the other methods. Filing was 5 business days. Coordination was concurrent with the SEC. What is the clock for qualification? Direct question for you, the listener.
This is the critical, highly testable distinction for qualification. There is no clock. It does not become effective automatically after a certain number of days. It is never concurrent with anything because there is no federal registration to be concurrent with. Registration by qualification becomes effective only when the administrator orders it.
It is entirely at cautious Carla's discretion. She could take a week. She could take 3 months if she keeps finding weird clauses in those material contracts.
Exactly. If an exam question describes a state-registered offering becoming effective without administrator action, if it happens automatically by operation of law, it must be filing or coordination. It cannot be qualification. Qualification always waits on the administrator's manual approval.
Okay, let's take a breath. We've covered the 3 methods. Filing for the giants. Coordination for the standard IPOs. Qualification for the local unproven startups. But whether Frank uses filing coordination or qualification, there are some house rules that cautious Carla enforces universally across the board.
Yes. The exam loves to test these universal provisions because recognizing that a rule applies to all methods is a testable skill in itself. A question might just say a registration statement under the Uniform Securities Act without naming a specific method, and you have to know these universal rules apply.
First universal rule. Who can actually file the registration statement? It doesn't have to be Frank, does it?
No. The registration statement may be filed by the issuer, which is Frank, but it could also be filed by a selling stockholder. For example, if an early investor owns a massive block of unregistered shares and wants to sell them to the public, that stockholder can file. Or very commonly, it can be filed by a registered broker-dealer like Broker Bob, acting on Frank's behalf.
Second universal rule duration. We touched on this earlier. How long does a registration last before Carla makes you do it all over again?
Every registration statement is effective for 1 year from its effective date. However, there's a strict rule about withdrawal. You cannot withdraw the registration statement within that first year if any securities of the same class are still outstanding in the public's hands.
Right. Think about the logic there. Frank can't go public, sell millions of dollars of stock to retail investors, and then 3 months later say, never mind, I'm pulling my registration. That would leave the public holding completely untradeable, unregistered shares. Carla forces Frank to stick around and maintain the registration for at least a year so the secondary market can function. Now, during that year, does Carla just ignore Frank?
No. While the registration is effective, Carla has the authority to require Frank to file reports to keep the information current and to disclose the progress of the offering. She wants to know how many shares have actually been sold. But the statute places a hard cap on how burdensome these reports can be. She can require these reports no more often than quarterly.
So if you see a question on the exam that says Carla is demanding monthly progress reports on Emucor's stock sale,
that is a trap. Quarterly is the absolute maximum frequency permitted by the USA. Demanding monthly or weekly reports would drown a small business in accounting fees, so the law forbids it.
Love it. Wow. Now, the biggest universal rule, which is actually a massive compare and contrast point, escrow and impounding. These sound like heavy regulatory tools. What are they?
CARLA has the power to protect retail investors from grab-and-run schemes orchestrated by shady promoters. She can require escrow. This means any stock that was issued to a promoter like Frank for something other than cash, say he gave himself 1 million shares in exchange for his intellectual property, or stock issued within the past 3 years for very cheap, must be deposited in a locked escrow account.
Why?
Because if the stock goes public at $10 a share, and Frank gave himself shares for 1 cent, his immediate incentive is to dump all his shares on the first day, crash the price, take his millions, and walk away from the company. Escrow locks his shares up for a period of time, forcing him to actually run the business.
That protects the share price. What about impounding?
Impounding applies to the cash coming in from the public during the IPO. CARLA can force Broker Bob to place all the sales proceeds into an independent impound account until a specific predetermined minimum amount of money is raised.
Give me a scenario for that.
Say Frank tells the public he needs exactly $1 million to build his underground emu farm. If he only raises $100,000, he can't build a farm. But without impounding, he might just take that $100,000, pay himself a salary, and let the company slowly die. Impounding, says Frank, you don't get to touch a single dime until Bob has raised the full million. If you fall short, the impound account returns all the money directly to the investors. It prevents undercapitalized companies from blowing partial funding.
That is incredibly smart regulation. But here's the critical question. We just went over the three methods: filing, coordination, qualification. Can cautious CARLA enforce escrow and registry, impounding on an offering using registration by filing? Direct question to the listener. Think about it.
She absolutely cannot. And let's connect that back to the teeter-totter logic.
Right. Think about who uses registration by filing. It's Route A seasoned issuers with 4 million net worth and 36 months of SEC history, or Route B massive mutual funds like Vanguard.
Exactly. You don't ask Apple to put its IPO proceeds in a piggy bank to make sure they raise enough money. You don't ask the CEO of Microsoft to lock his shares in escrow because you're afraid he's going to flee the country. Escrow and impounding are regulatory tools specifically designed to control risky, unproven promoters. Therefore, CARLA can only impose escrow and impounding on registration by coordination and registration by qualification. She can never impose them on feeling.
If the exam asks which methods allow escrow, eliminate filing immediately. Look for coordination and qualification only. All right, let's talk about CARLA's favorite weapon, the administrator's hammer. Stop orders. We've mentioned these a few times. What exactly is a stop order?
A stop order is the ultimate administrative enforcement tool. CARLA uses it to deny effectiveness to a pending registration or to suspend or revoke a registration that is already effective. It stops the offering dead in its tracks. No more sales.
But CARLA can't just issue a stop order because she's having a bad day, right? She can't say, I think underground emus are a stupid business model. I'm shutting this down.
No, she cannot act arbitrarily. The Uniform Securities Act requires a strict two-prong test before a stop order can be issued. First, CARLA must make a formal finding that the order is in the public interest. Second, she must identify at least one specific statutory ground listed in the Act. She needs both. Public interest alone is not enough. And a statutory ground alone without the public interest finding is not enough.
What counts as a statutory ground?
The grounds include things like the registration statement is incomplete or contains a false or misleading material statement, or there's a willful violation of the act by the issuer or underwriter, or the issuer's business includes activities that are strictly illegal where performed, or the offering works of fraud upon purchasers.
Or my personal favorite, unreasonable compensation. If Frank tries to pay Broker Bob a 40% commission on every sale, CARLA can issue a stop order based on unreasonable underwriters' discounts, or if the offering terms are just fundamentally unfair, unjust, or inequitable.
Yes, unjust or inequitable gives her a lot of latitude, provided she also finds it's in the public interest. There's also a ground if the security is subject to a stop order from another state. But there's a caveat here. CARLA can only use another state's stop order as a ground if the facts behind that other order would currently be a valid stop order ground in her state. She can't just blindly follow another administrator's lead if her own state laws differ.
Okay, so CARLA has the public interest and she has a statutory ground. Let's say she catches Frank lying about his emu egg production. Massive fraud. How does she actually issue the stop order? Does Frank get his day in court before she shuts him down?
This is where we see Carla's expedited enforcement powers. Carla can shoot first. If she sees fraud, she can issue a summary suspension. This immediately suspends the registration. She does not need to hold a hearing first. She just drops the hammer.
But she has to at least tell Frank she did it right.
Yes. Upon entering the summary suspension, she must promptly notify Frank and Broker Bob that the order was entered and the reasons why.
And then what? Frank is just shut down forever based on Carla's unilateral decision.
No due process kicks in. Frank has the right to request a hearing in writing. Once Carla receives that written request, she is placed on a strict statutory clock. She must set the matter down for a hearing within 15 days of receiving the request.
15 days, remember that number. Summary suspension means immediate action, no prior hearing, but a guaranteed hearing within 15 days if requested.
Now, how is that different from a final stop order?
A final stop order is a permanent action, not a temporary suspension. Because it is final, it requires full due process before it is entered. Before Carla can enter a final stop order, she must provide three things appropriate prior notice to all interested parties, an opportunity for a hearing and written findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Summary suspension is the emergency brake. Final stop order is dismantling the car. Now, there is a rule regarding stop orders that feels like a massive exam trap, the 30-day no takebacks rule. It is a major trap, but once you understand the logic, it makes perfect sense. Let's set a scenario. Frank files his intrastate offering using registration by qualification. Carla reads all 17 categories of his paperwork. While reading his material contracts, she notices that Frank's land lease for the emu farm has a slightly misleading clause. It is technically a statutory ground for a stop order, but Carla decides it's relatively minor. It's not a huge threat to the public, and she approves the registration anyway. It becomes effective.
Okay, so Frank is out there legally selling stock, believing he is in the clear.
Right. Now, 40 days go by. Carla wakes up in a bad mood. She remembers that land lease decides she actually does hate it and tries to issue a stop order today based solely on that lease she knew about 40 days ago. Can she do it?
I mean, if she knew about it and let it slide, it seems incredibly unfair to shut him down for it a month later.
And the law agrees with you. The rule states that the administrator may not institute a stop order proceeding against an effective registration statement based on a fact known to her at the time it became effective unless she institutes the proceeding within the next 30 days.
This protects businesses from regulatory extortion. Carla can't just hold a minor known flaw over Frank's head for a year and threaten to shut him down whenever she feels like it. Capital markets require certainty. Once a stock is trading, you can't yank it based on old news. She has 30 days to speak up, or she has to forever hold her peace regarding that specific fact.
Exactly. Regulatory certainty is the goal. But to be crystal clear, if she discovers a new fact, if she finds out on day 40 that Frank has secretly been embezzling investor funds to buy a yacht, the 30-day limit does not apply. She just learned about the embezzlement. She can issue a stop order immediately. The rule only protects facts known at the time of effectiveness.
That is brilliant. Okay, we have covered the entire state landscape. The federal VIPs, the teeter-totter of filing coordination and qualification, the universal rules, and Carla's stop orders. But the study material has one final section we need to hit, the federal registration timeline.
Yes. Even though this is a state law exam, they explicitly test the federal offering timeline that runs parallel to these state rules, usually in the context of coordination. You need to know exactly how Broker Bob's life changes during the three phases of a standard IPO.
Let's break it down. Phase one, pre-filing. Frank has a great idea, but he hasn't filed a single piece of paper with the SEC yet. He and Bob are just talking in a coffee shop planning the IPO. What can Bob do regarding his clients?
Bob can do absolutely nothing. The rule during the pre-filing phase is absolute. No offers, no sales.
And this brings us all the way back to the start of the deep dive. Bob cannot call his clients and say, hey, hypothetically, if Frank took his emu farm public next month, would you be interested in buying some shares?
If he does that, he violates the Securities Act of 1933. That is soliciting an offer to buy. The pre-filing offer ban is the broadest of all prohibitions. Any solicitation before a federal registration statement is actually filed is illegal, regardless of whether a sale ever happens or any money changes hands. You cannot prime the market.
Okay, so Frank's lawyers finally finished the paperwork. They filed a registration statement with the SEC. We now enter phase two, the cooling off period, also known as the waiting period. The SEC is reviewing the documents, but the registration is not yet effective. The statutory cooling off period is 20 days. What can Bob do now?
The rules relax slightly. Oral offers are now permitted, Bob can finally pick up the phone, call his clients, and talk about the upcoming offering. He can gauge their interest.
Great. So he can email them a glossy full-color brochure he made himself with pictures of the emus?
Absolutely not. During the cooling-off period, written offers are strictly limited and highly regulated. The only permitted written offer is the preliminary prospectus, often called the red herring.
Why is it called a red herring?
Because it must have a statement printed in red ink on the cover page explicitly stating that a registration statement has been filed but is not yet effective, and the securities may not be sold until it is. It's a warning label.
So oral offers are okay. Written offers are strictly limited to the red herring prospectus. What about actual sales? Can Bob take a client's check and close the deal?
No sales. Sales remain completely, absolutely prohibited until the registration statement is fully effective. Bob can take indications of interest, meaning a client can say, I'd like to buy 100 shares when it goes live, but Bob cannot accept money and he cannot finalize a contract.
Got it. Now, what about tombstone ads? Our sources highlight this as a key testable concept during the cooling off period.
A tombstone ad is a very specific bare bones notice that a company is permitted to publish during the cooling off period. It gets its name because it looks like a tombstone. It's usually just plain black text in a box in the financial section of a newspaper, completely devoid of any hype, flashy graphics, or sales pitches.
What can a tombstone ad actually say?
It is strictly limited to identifying basic facts. The name of the security, the name of the issuer, the proposed price or price range, the size of the offering, and critically, it must state where the reader can obtain a copy of the preliminary prospectus.
What is it not? What is the exam going to try to trick me with?
The exam will ask if a tombstone ad constitutes an offer to sell the security. It does not. A tombstone ad is legally not considered an offer. Furthermore, it is not a substitute for a prospectus. A purchaser must still receive the final prospectus before or at the time of sale. The tombstone is merely an announcement that the offering exists and tells you where to find the actual paperwork.
Okay, phase three, post-effective. The 20-day cooling off period ends. The SEC reviews the final price amendment. The SEC says go. Cautious Carlos coordination state registration says go concurrently. What can Bob do now?
The floodgates open. Sales are now legally allowed and all types of offers are allowed. But there is one absolute non-negotiable condition any sale must be accompanied by or preceded by the delivery of the final prospectus.
No sales without final prospectus delivery. It is the ultimate disclosure document.
Right.
Okay, we have run the gauntlet. We have taken Frank, Bob, and Carla from the pre-filing silence all the way to final legal sales. We've navigated federal covered VIPs. We've ridden the teeter-totter of state registration, and we've survived Carla's stop orders. I want to do a rapid-fire recap of the most critical takeaways. Let's lock this in. Rule one, federal covered securities bypass state registration. But remember the hierarchy. Exchange-listed securities bypass everything, no notice filing, no fees, no stop orders. Mutual funds and the uncapped Rule 506 Reg D tier bypass registration, but Carla still demands her notice filing cover charge.
Rule 2. Registration by filing, also called notification, is for the giants. It has the hardest eligibility, but the easiest filing burden. Remember the strict 5-business-day wait for seasoned issuers before they become concurrent with the SEC? And remember the separate route for mutual funds with a 24-month prior qualification and no 5-day wait.
Rule 3. Registration by coordination is for standard IPOs filing with SEC. 10 calendar days on file with Carla, 2 full business days for the max min price statement. It becomes effective concurrently with the SEC, provided Bob remembers to call Carla and avoid the oops penalty.
Rule 4. Registration by qualification is the fallback method for interstate local offerings. Any security can use it. No SEC filing is required. It requires 17 grueling categories of information, and it becomes effective only when the administrator manually orders it.
Rule 5. Escrow and impounding can be forced on coordination and qualification, but never on registration by filing. Apple doesn't need a piggy bank.
Rule 6. Stop orders require two things, a public interest finding plus a statutory ground. Summary suspensions happen immediately without a hearing, but guarantee a hearing within 15 days of a written request. And remember, the 30-day rule, Carla can't issue a stop order based on old news she knew at the time of effectiveness once 30 days have passed.
Unbelievable. We crushed it. But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Something to mull over while you finish your walk or your commute or wherever you are right now.
Think about the core tension we've explored today. On one hand, the global capital markets are designed to move at lightning speed. Billions of dollars are transacted in milliseconds. Broker Bob wants to click a button and move capital instantly to fund innovation.
But on the other hand, the Uniform Securities Act, written decades ago, intentionally forces deliberate, agonizing friction into the system. It builds walls. It demands 5 business day, waits 10 day, holds 17-part qualification checklists, and heavy red stop order stamps.
It asks us a fundamental question about how we want our economy to run. Is all this friction, this massive bureaucratic machinery of filing, coordination, and qualifications a relic of an analog past that slows down growth? Or is cautious Carla, with her escrow accounts, her impound requirements, and her 30-day time limits, the absolute only thing keeping the Frank, the founders of the world, from burning down the entire financial system with underground emu farms and hollow promises?
It is a delicate, precarious balance between facilitating capital and preventing catastrophe. And it's exactly that balance you're going to be tested on.
Mull that over. You have the tools, you understand the logic, you can visualize the teeter-totter. You are going to beat this exam. Good luck out there.